This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wage World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the U.S., and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wage World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Mississippi, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kvf.org. A podcast will be available this show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wage World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Professor Joshua Akers, University of Michigan at Dearborn, Michigan. Welcome to Wage World, Josh.
Thank you, Wade. It's a pleasure to be here.
Josh and I met as part of our Home Savers campaign a couple of, 6 months ago now. I was going to say a couple of months ago, because Josh and his colleagues have done some really groundbreaking work looking at deep cuts on the data of how housing markets are being affected, particularly in the Detroit area. Josh, let's introduce people to some of what your work has uncovered.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that we're very much interested in are the kinds of pressures that people are facing, particularly in low-income housing markets. So increases in evictions, different kinds of rental contracts or land contracts, lack of access to mortgages, all of those things. And so working with a number of groups, what we've tried to do is both map areas that are being highly affected by particularly speculative activity, where they're likely to encounter land contracts or other pieces, but to also use that data to create strategies to counteract those changes in neighborhoods, or those forces in the neighborhoods that are there. So if people are interested in it, they can find the map at propertypraxis, praxis.org.
Well, I know we'll be giving that website a couple more times, but Property Praxis is something you and some associates have put together that really gives a deep look at these housing patterns, right?
Yes, absolutely. The idea of it is just to give anybody in the community that's interested in seeing what's going on in their neighborhood the ability to identify who owns houses, what speculators are operating in their neighborhood, and to come together with other groups to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, I know in Detroit particularly, we were looking at land contracts, which is a big sort of catch-all for rent-to-own, lease-purchase options, contract for deeds, whatever you might call them. But essentially, it's not renting and it's not owning, but it often verges on the old slum landlord practices and times gone by when there was racial discrimination and other thing in housing. But this has become huge. Really has grown in the Detroit market recently from what your figures have shown.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, land contracts outpace all other types of mortgage instruments for housing. So whether that's subprime or anything else, the primary way of purchasing a house in Detroit at this point in time is through these land contracts. The thing about
Let me just put a point on that. More land contracts were recorded and implemented last several years in Detroit than were conventional mortgages, right?
Absolutely.
And that's for the whole market, not just in lower-income areas.
That's the whole market, and that's since 2008, so almost a decade.
Since the Great Recession and the housing bubble popped all over us and actually eliminated a generation of home ownership increases, particularly for African Americans and Latinos throughout the country. So this shows that this has been, I mean, I think you educated me on this, because I'd like to believe that some of this land contract stuff had disappeared with HMDA and CRA laws a generation ago, but it's always been about 4%, and it really soared in Detroit metropolitan area, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's always been about 4%. It's always been a part of the and a part of the Michigan housing market for a long period in time, not just low-income housing markets, but across the board. It's an old instrument, right? So you're very familiar with the work in, you know, with the Contract Buyers League and work in Chicago around these instruments in the 60s and early 70s. But it kind of persisted here in Michigan over that time. It's an incredibly flexible way to do contracts. So it can have a lot of advantages if you're doing low-income housing, if your intent is to kind of keep people in homes and provide an opportunity for home ownership. But that flexibility offers also a lot of opportunity for exploitation. And that's what we see increase dramatically in the city of Detroit after 2008. Contracts with, you know, the maximum interest, which I believe is 11% allowed in Michigan, down payments that exceed the actual purchase price of the property from for the owner. So the owner
had, and that's crazy, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's like five or six times what they actually paid for the property.
And because in Detroit, because of the longstanding deindustrialization and housing problems, you could potentially get a property for, you know, $500 or $1,000 in some ways, couldn't you? The land bank, I know, is a minimum $1,000, isn't it?
Well, that's, yeah, so that's one of the places. This year was, I think, a minimum of 1,000, but they've been, or the land bank itself is a minimum of 1,000. But one of the two areas that we've tracked where speculators, basically people owning five or more houses using these kinds of land contracts, are purchasing their property, were initially through mortgage foreclosure markets, which at the height of the, basically at the height of the foreclosure crisis, the average bulk purchase price was about $500 per property. So they were basically buying from Fannie and Freddie at $500 a property, and then turning around, selling those off to other people. And then as that mortgage foreclosure market has kind of slowed, in the case of Detroit, we have kind of very high tax assessments that were never brought into line with the actual values of houses. And so we have thousands and thousands of people that have been losing their homes to tax foreclosure over the last decade as well. And that's where we see most of these contract sellers purchasing their inventory.
There's tax auctions now. I mean, I want to add while we're talking about that in Detroit, one of the, I hate to even call it a unique factor because it's so terrible for people, but unpaid water bills can also trigger foreclosures, because those go into the, those are coupled with tax problems, aren't they?
They were for a while. I'm not sure if that's still the case, but there are still people going through the system that had basically water bills tacked onto their taxes, yeah.
I know we ran into a case in Inkster recently where someone was on a land contract and they were facing eviction with something like $1,200 worth of back taxes and $3,500 worth of a back water bill. So clearly, maybe they're not still adding them, and we'll have to check on that, Josh. But, yeah. Boy, there's still a lot of people facing that kind of crisis who haven't been able to resolve it. So Detroit's been a hot mess. Now, Fannie Mae, at least, and we were involved in some of this, has blocked from any future auctions any of these companies that are involved in what we sometimes call as-is arrangements, the land contract kinds of things that Professor Akers and I are talking about. But tax auctions in many markets around the country are still huge, and Certainly, the big company in Detroit is something called Detroit Property Exchange, and they've long specialized in this, in getting properties from tax auctions, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. They're one of the more active speculative buyers within tax foreclosure auctions. It's owned by a guy named Michael Kelly, who lives in the Detroit suburbs, and has been basically, he buys properties in different ways. One, thinking of projects that, community development projects or other projects that may go into those neighborhoods. So he's buying to kind of force them to pay more to him for having that property. But on the other end, he rents out a lot of properties or sells properties via land contract. He was responsible for nearly 1,800 eviction filings over the last 5 years.
Wow. And does that require him getting a lawyer? He just walks into...
Yeah, he has an in-house lawyer, actually, yeah, that he used. So he has a lawyer on staff. I guess when you're filing that quantity...
Yeah, he could keep somebody busy, couldn't he?
It's probably cost-effective. But yeah, he's been one of the major speculative players in the trade market for a long period of time.
We're talking to Joshua Akers, who's a professor at the University of Michigan at Dearborn, which is the close-in suburb of Detroit, and we're talking about real estate markets. This is part of what we call a credit desert, isn't it, Josh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's not a lot of the last time I looked, I believe there was about 4% of all housing, 4% of all housing sales in Detroit in 2015 were via conventional mortgage instruments. So that's under 100, or that's about, it's under 100 properties.
Well, I know even a New York Times article talking about some year was talking literally about, 50 from one company and 20 from another. And these were big money center banks, the Wells Fargo's and the Bank America's and the Citi, that kind of league. People that just can't get a mortgage. And that's because of the standards, or they just because of the property values aren't high enough? I mean, what has caused this desert to be so arid in Detroit?
Well, I mean, there's a number of reasons that could go into it. I think number one is, it's the property values themselves. Most mortgage companies won't think of it, or won't look at anything under $60,000 as a minimum for a mortgage. So a number of those programs banks that you've mentioned have kind of entered into specialized programs with the City of Detroit and some foundations that work on providing mortgages to people. So one is the housing price, but that price has been produced through other kinds of practices. So one is the subprime mortgage crisis, right? So basically offering mortgages on inflated values and houses within the City of Detroit, which when the subprime mortgage crisis collapsed, creates a large number of foreclosures, which are then purchased for about $500. At the same time, those that are purchased are just kind of left to decline. So you see the decline of neighborhoods pushing down housing prices as well.
And this is the whole problem we know about and hear about, people being underwater when their mortgage is because of the subprime and the whole rental, the whole depression, recession crisis 10 years ago, when they owe more on the mortgage than the current value of the house.
Absolutely, yeah.
And some people walked away, and some people are still trying to, stay treading water, so to speak, if we keep this metaphor going. But for a lot of people, that meant it was easier and actually a smarter financial decision to go ahead and take the credit hit or whatever it was on your record and let it be foreclosed. And now that leads to Fannie Mae dumping properties back on the market, as Josh was explaining, at 500. Now, you've been involved in a an interesting organization. I know we met with, when we were there, the Detroit Eviction Defense. What do they do?
It's a mutual aid organization, right? So it's people that come from all different walks of life, former auto workers, unionists, religious leaders, academics, any number of people, right? Anybody that's interested in the idea that people have a right to remain in place, right? An idea of trying to prevent eviction. But the group itself is about giving people the support and tools they need to stand up and go as far as they want in their fight to stay in their home. They don't provide legal support. They don't have financial support, but they provide emotional and kind of social support, and will also do eviction defenses where they set up barricades, or they try to prevent dumpsters from being placed in front of homes.
What we might call direct action support. That's and it's been very effective in many cases, hasn't it, Josh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's the direct action. They've had over 50 cases in which they've had success. It's continued to go. You know, it's been going for almost 7 or over 5 years now. Yeah.
And it was an outgrowth of the Occupy movement, wasn't it? Am I remembering wrong?
No, you're not remembering wrong. It was the Housing Committee for Occupy Detroit, and the outgrowth there was as Occupy was transitioning. They recognized the need the number of people had to prevent. There are a number of people who were facing eviction, and they found that direct action was a means for them to assist.
You can tell I'm lobbying on Wage World today that more of the Occupy groups or veterans of Occupies that might be listening, that this eviction defense would be a great project to rekindle some of that energy in these days and times. We're talking to Joshua Akers, who's a professor at the University of Michigan at Dearborn. Josh, you turned us on to a study in Atlanta about corporate eviction rates, which was just alarming. Atlanta turned out to have the 21% eviction rate for corporate real estate holdings. Detroit was also high, as was Cleveland. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of transitions that we see kind of falling. I mean, the financial crisis seems to be kind of huge here, right, a decade on. So the stuff that I'm looking at is, like, how are individual single-family homeowners being affected by land contracts and that involves with evictions? But there's a whole other set or a whole other market that developed out of that crisis, and that is the kind of corporate or institutional landlord. So companies, Wall Street investment firms, purchasing large numbers of single-family homes and turning them into rentals.
This is huge in the Atlanta market. I mean, all the big hedge funds picked up thousands of foreclosed properties and have tried, and sometimes they claim that they've spruced them up even, but they've become big landlords in several markets around the country, haven't they?
Absolutely. So the kinds of land contract stuff that I work on, you see that some in more stable or hotter housing markets, but it's often in kind of low-income areas with depressed housing markets for long periods of time. But corporate landlords, you could think of Atlanta, Phoenix, Los Angeles, any of your bigger, larger housing markets that have seen a lot of growth over the last couple of decades is where you're seeing these people like Blackstone operate. But there's a second component to these kind of corporate landlords that are growing. So one is they turn single-family homes into rentals. Those rental rates go up annually. That's just kind of institutionalized through an algorithm. Everything is managed online. There's usually a local property manager. But on the back end, they've basically securitized rental contracts. So much like prior prior to the mortgage crisis that we had, in which they were selling, basically selling future or selling off packages of mortgages to investors. In this case, they're selling off packages of rental agreements to investors. So basically, the same kind of instrument that helped, or that the same kind of instrument that in part led to the mortgage crisis is now being used in the corporate rental market.
Well, in some cases, even the land contract market is based on investor pools buying tranches of these sort of land purchase option contracts. This could be something we're going to see become more popular in that part of the low-income housing market as well.
Absolutely.
Certainly, Vision Property Management, that's fundamental to their business model, a company out of Columbia, South Carolina, that's probably the biggest, the 3,000 properties, so probably the largest lease purchase option company with that business model. It's a wild time out there. And you started recently looking at whether or not this more nationally in addition to the Detroit area. Is that correct, Josh?
Yeah, we're beginning to kind of branch out and try and figure out what's going on in other cities.
And how does this Praxis software help people do that?
Well, the idea behind it and the way that we built it was very much in that kind of mutual aid idea. So it's all open source. Anybody can download it. Anybody can use it. But the idea is that you can ask whatever question it is that you have about property or something else, and then project it on a map. So we've been working with other organizations in a number of cities about how to kind of pull down data, to look at property markets, to understand kind of how speculation is working, and then how to turn that around and put it into the same kind of online mapping that we're using. We've been working with people in Baltimore, Buffalo, Chicago. There's a really great group out of San Francisco that has, they have their entirely own system called the Anti-Eviction Mapping Campaign.
Anti-eviction, what did you call it? Mapping campaign?
The anti-eviction mapping campaign. And they do really great work, both in terms of mapping how evictions are happening, but also tying that to incidents of police violence, kind of reporting calls and complaints on homeless people, the rise of kind of tech buses in neighborhoods, the way gentrification is kind of working within the city itself, and then interviewing those people that are facing these kinds of eviction pressures. So it's a really comprehensive project that both details how kind of these power relationships and financial relationships are working, but also the way in which people are working to prevent it. Right.
If we're in Memphis or New Orleans or Dallas or someplace like that that isn't doing this, how could people in those communities become part of this sort of, I don't want to call it research project, because this is really about giving people the information to be able to take action on housing issues at, in their own communities. But how would they get involved in this, or what could they do?
Absolutely. Well, they can go to the website, propertypraxis.org. We also have the research component of that, which is Urban Praxis. You can look it up. Or you can just email me at jm, as in Michael, AKERS, at umich, umich.edu. We're always interested in talking to people or hear what people are interested in. There are ways that we can offer support if people are interested in this kind of project, whether that's, feeding data into us or helping you identify where to get the data, maybe helping you with a bit of the technical component. we're more than willing to host that kind of information, whether that be Memphis or anywhere else, on the same site with Detroit, so that people can see how these processes are operating across the United States.
Yeah, this is these could really put bullets in the gun for a lot of community organizations who are trying to get their arms around the housing crisis. We're going to give these websites and Josh's emails again before we leave. Are you in trying to keep an eyeball around the country in terms of we really see sort of twin problems? Rents are escalating and eviction rates. So people are really going to be caught in a squeeze, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's, I mean, so I guess looking at changes in the in low-income housing markets after the financial crisis, evictions have always been part, right, of low-income markets, but we've seen them increase dramatically. In the case of Detroit, evictions have increased 5 times in the last 5 years. This is becoming a systemic part of the housing market, and so understanding how it's operating, both in terms of rising rents, but also that kind of squeeze on the other end with land contracts and a lack of access to credit, and ways in which groups across the country are organizing to confront these issues is essential. It's not, given the current political lay of the land, it's highly unlikely that we're going to see anything that comes close to addressing the kinds of housing issues that we have in the country.
This doesn't exactly fit with what we're talking about today, but there was a court decision, which was a little bit of good news. A federal judge in the district court based in D.C. overturned a HUD proposal to delay for another 2 years, changing the way Section 8 reimbursements are calculated. I know you're familiar with this probably as well, Josh, but it was based on a metropolitan area, and now it's going to be based on what the average in a zip code is, which means that people could potentially move to, relatively speaking, better neighborhoods and not be so ghettoized by many Section 8 offerings in at least 23 metropolitan areas around the country, because they can move to get a higher reimbursement in a zip code that where the rents are higher, rather than being trapped in a ceiling Section 8. It's not going to make much difference in the land contract desert, lending desert, but it will make a difference in terms of what Section 8 recipient or, you know, voucher holders can do, won't it?
Yes, absolutely. That makes it. I mean, that can have a significant difference for a number of people.
In this particular decision, 200,000 people in 23 metropolitan areas are going to be affected. And I think one was Chicago and Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Fort Worth, Arlington, Honolulu, places like that. A lot of places in Florida, Tampa, West Palm Beach, Jacksonville. So be nice if it was national, but at least it's a step forward.
Absolutely.
So let's give people again the website if they and their communities would like to start getting involved in this. It was, I think, Property Praxis. That's PRAXIS, Property Praxis, and that's .org, is it, Josh? What is the full thing?
That's right, .org.
So propertypraxis.org, and the other place that Josh mentioned was Urban Praxis. What was the name of that?
It's urbanpraxis.org. It's just an umbrella that we use for a number of different projects we have going on.
And Josh, give your email again so that people know how to get a hold of you.
jmakers @umich.edu. So jmakers @umich.edu.
So we're promoting, you hear what Josh has to say, Professor Akers and his colleagues, both in Michigan and now elsewhere around the country, have done some path-breaking work here. So the closer and faster we can look at this data and get some capacity for community organizations to deal with, the better. Thank you, Josh. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have...